Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your eldest Barry of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. We are back, quarantined, isolated, Verite Popcast, live from the home studio. Last week was a bonanza. We had two very big episodes. A lot of folks came through. And we are going to keep up that energy this week because I have been struggling with a question that is probably central to my job, which is what is the point? What is the role of criticism right now? And I don't mean criticism being negative. I mean the job of criticism, of assessing art. I've had to write a bunch of pieces over the last couple of weeks, and I have felt emotionally different about each of them. I've done some straight record reviews. I reviewed the Uzi albums. I reviewed Bad Bunny and J Balvin. You know, the Bad Bunny was a really good example of something that was kind of a joy to do during this kind of tumultuous time. We opened up with Safaera. That's one of my favorite songs on the Bad Bunny album. Bad Bunny with some 2000s reggaeton stars, Yaoli Randy and Yengo Flow. It gave me a lot to think about Bad Bunny's role as a tastemaker and where he is focusing his energy and kind of the role, how reggaeton is finally starting to look backwards and embrace its history, not just kind of move in some of the softer global pop directions that some of the mainstream stars like J Balvin have been moving in. That was a great opportunity to get absorbed in a record and write about it. I also wrote about the horrific Imagine cover, which I know Pedro will not let me play a sample of. And frankly, I would never punish you to listen to it. But as you know, Gal Gadot got a bunch of her celebrity friends to record a kind of baton passing version of John Lennon's Imagine, which is not even like a happy or soothing song, TBQH. And that was horrific. And I felt so much bile towards it that I felt like I had to write about it. Anyway, that's been kind of the range of my last couple weeks. And I got to thinking, what would I want to see from music criticism and from music critics during this time? And so on this episode of Popcast, we're going to be checking in with a bunch of different folks. We're going to be checking in with Rob Arvilla from The Ringer. We're going to be checking in with Lindsay Zolads, who writes for us at The Times and Pitchfork and New York Magazine and all kinds of places. And we're going to check in with Craig Jenkins from New York Magazine and Vulture. And we're going to talk about where our heads are at, what music can do for us in this time, what music criticism should do in circumstances like this. I also want to say, in addition to sort of agonizing over the role of music criticism, this is a chaotic time for the arts, broadly speaking. Concerts, festivals, tours being canceled, indie musicians living show to show, paycheck to paycheck, are in dire need of assistance. The entire ecosystem that has slowly chipped away at artists being able to make money off of their records is now threatening an entire generation of musicians. Also, on top of that, you have the very real health challenges that are happening in the world. And we are in a position where coronavirus has already started to claim the lives of people whose music that we all know. Before we continue today, I do want to say rest in peace, Manu Dibango, and also Arliss Mabile, who's a great Soukous musician. This is the first real wave of casualties that we're seeing in the music business. Lucian Grange, who is the president of Universal Music, is also hospitalized right now with the coronavirus. So I just want us to be mindful that the toll of this is going to hit us in a number of different ways. So first, checking in, we've got the boy, Rob Arvilla.
You got it.
From The Ringer. We have a 2-week streak of Columbus, Ohio on Popcast. Hanif last week, Rob this week. Rob, as you know, has been on Popcast plenty before. One of the great music critics in the country. Rob, why? Here's my question. Why? I have some whys. I don't know that, and I don't have an answer for. What have you been writing critically in this moment? I know you did a feature that came out today, but like, have you been writing critically? Is the threshold different? Is your approach different? Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been sitting here all day trying to write about Pearl Jam. I don't know if you've ever had this experience.
No. My generation and my affiliations prevent me from having to do that.
I had a feeling. You know, I've been a fan of Pearl Jam for whatever it is, 30 years or so now. I like this new record quite a bit. I am having far more severe attention span issues today than usual. Last week, I wrote about The Weeknd, you know, which is sort of challenging from a frivolity standpoint in the best of times. And these are notably, you know, the worst of times. You know, it's in moments like these, I vacillate between wanting everything I write to like speak explicitly to the moments, you know, and to the headlines, to the zeitgeist, or conversely, like, sometimes I have this impulse to just avoid reality altogether and like embrace the idea that this is escapism and like this is what you'll listen to or what you'll read is like a respite from the news. You know, this is a safe space for Eddie Vedder, you know, apostles such as myself.
Right, exactly. Like all around the country and the world, people are waiting for a moment that they can think exclusively about Eddie Vedder. And you want to give them that moment.
And here I am.
You want to be the host body for that moment. That's bad. We're going to delete that.
That's the, what can you joke about at this point is also,
Gosh.
Oh man, this is terrible. It's like the last time I had a feeling like this, honestly, was after the election in 2016, mm-hmm. you know, and I had like a very intense personal existential, like, what am I doing with my life sort of crisis that I like tried to keep out of my writing, but like, I'm not going to return to my writing now to see if I actually managed to do that. But like, I spent a couple months being like, how does this Miranda Lambert double album like reflect our national mood and whatever. And that sort of like blank is a blank for the Trump era construction, I think, had its use very momentarily, but like got really stale really fast.
And they were always kind of lies because they were records that were made 6 months prior or a year prior or 2 years prior. So they weren't actually on the subject. And to be honest, most of the stuff that we write about resists those kind of interpretations day to day in any political climate. So you can kind of retrospectively look at things and say, well, if I choose to see things through the lens of Corona pandemic, the Trump administration, Hurricane Katrina, 9/11, etc., you can find, I'm sure, some productive threads. But obviously, that's not what these particular works of art are designed for. They're not built for that. And I sort of struggled. The thing that you say about writing a piece that's kind of a respite from all the other stuff versus how do I bring all the other stuff into this? So when I was writing about Bad Bunny and J Balvin, I had two things. One, there is no real way to bring in the current moment to a piece like that. That was a double review that I had thought about writing, you know, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, before any of this started. That was already something that I had in mind as how I was going to treat these records. So that's one. So the falsity of imposing it is one thing. But then when I got down to the nitty gritty of the work, I think the Bad Bunny record is really good. I was really happy to have 2 hours, 3 hours of listening to really like get inside of it, you know, yesterday. But then when I listened to the Balvin record, I was like, man, this is kind of bleak, to be honest. And it's like a fine album, but it is so, a word I really should have used is like, it's really stain resistant. You know what I mean? Like, it's so polished, it's so gleaming, it's so kind of exists in its ecosystem outside of anything else. Like, it's just, it exists only for its own neon and kind of not much more. Listening to that felt dispiriting. Like, maybe on the best of weeks, I could have found some kind of entry point into it psychologically that made me say, this is a B+, not a C+, you know, or a C or whatever. But in this particular moment, listening to a record that did so little. It doesn't have to do anything political. You know what I mean? It doesn't have to do anything social. It just did so little. Like, the Bad Bunny record does so much. So you kind of want to tap into it and get excited and like feel all the textures. But this Balvin record, I was like, man, it's just not doing anything. And like, Lord knows, right this moment, please do something. That's all I can kind of access right now.
This Dua Lipa record is coming out, right? And it's like, I really like Dua Lipa. Like, is this going to be what I want? Is it explicitly going to be like not what I want? Am I going to find it like apt? Or is it going to describe like a universe and like a state of affairs that as of 2 weeks ago, like, doesn't exist anymore? Like, I'm trying not... You know, I understand what you're saying, but it's like, it's not their fault that the record, as you say, that they made like months ago does not speak to the concerns, you know, of mid-March 2020. Like, the Pearl Jam record is about like apocalypse and like self-annihilation and sort of hunkering down and like feeling like you're under attack. Like, it's close enough to evoking this moment. It's just a question of severity, but it's just, nobody could have sort of predicted the specificity of just the terror and the frustration and the exasperation of this moment. And I would be a little alarming to me if there was a new piece of music that did describe to me how I'm feeling right now. I would find that almost invasive.
I'm going to keep beating this drum every week on Popcast. But if I was Rihanna right now, I would be recording a fire Corona apocalypse jam, appending it to R7 and just dropping it on like a random Wednesday afternoon and just be like, it's lit. Let's go.
From your lips to God's ears. Absolutely. Absolutely.
By God, you mean Rihanna. So
I do.
Look, even in the best of times, the act of criticism is sort of a fraught thing right now. Do you feel like, you say you like this Pearl Jam record that you're about to write about? What would be your vibe? What would be your feeling if it was a piece of art that you felt negatively about?
I think I would be less inclined to be super negative about it. Like, I want to tell you, I will tell you honestly that the first great piece of music criticism that this state of affairs has produced is you on the Celebrity Imagine. First of all, the word cluster clump, which I am very excited to say on this podcast, it's just, that is as close to anyone as anyone has gotten to sort of like what I want out of music, out of conversation about music at this point, is to express frustration and just sort of rage almost. And so what I'm struggling with right now, both as a critic and as just a lover of music, is what music is for, like right this second. Like, Paralysis wrote beautifully about not going to concerts, any sort of live event, clubs, DJs, whatever. Like, even driving anywhere, you know, that isn't like Costco or whatever is suddenly out. Like, when Pop Smoke died, a thing a lot of people said was that everyone talked about how Welcome to the Party was that official song that was blaring out of every car window in New York City that summer. And like, I don't live in New York anymore, but like, I remember that. I remember like Beamer Benz or Bentley or whatever. And like, that image is so beautiful to me, and just the highest possible tributes you can pay a song, you can pay an artist, which of course only made me sadder and like quadruply so now that even that, you know, we don't have that right now. We don't have that communal application of music.
We do have a guy. There is a guy. I think I talked about this last week. There's a guy who parks outside my window and blasts the radio.
That's me, actually. But yeah.
Oh, okay. You were playing a great Young MA song yesterday while I was like trying to muscle through the Balvin record. This guy was playing a great Young MA song, and I was like, I would so much rather be writing about this song.
There we go.
Anyway, shouts to Young MA, sure, whose song Big, to me, actually sort of very much in the vein of ooh. So that was blasting outside the window. Let's listen to a little bit of Young MA to kind of like, let's boost the move. Let's serotonin up the episode. Here's a little Young MA and the soundtrack of Park Slope Streets.
Yeah, I'm Young MA, but she called me Poppy.
Have Have you been in your car very much at all the last week, week and change?
I haven't. You know, I'm here in, you know, suburban Columbus, Ohio, you know, and so it's I haven't been. And so I haven't even been walking around a whole lot, which is my ideal way to absorb music, is just to walk around, you know, my suburban neighborhood and, you know, like listen to Pearl Jam or whatever I'm working on. Like, it's just I've been monitoring myself for what music I turn to in a crisis such as this, like what I find soothing, what I want to hear. And I don't know how to feel about the fact that I haven't hit on anything yet. Like, I'm listening to what I have to listen to for work, but I haven't found that yet. And I'm wondering if that on itself, in and of itself, is sort of alarming.
I actually totally agree. And I don't think I've hit on it either. And I think the reason I haven't hit on it is because for me, the feeling is not stable. One of the things I talked about last week when people were calling in and like offering recommendation, like mood recommendations, one of the things I found myself talking about is like, it, for me, a song has to very specifically hit a mood. It can't pull me to a different place. It's got to like land exactly where I am. And I feel like every day is different. So the idea that I also then would have to think hard about what song would match, you know, it's like, it's, I mean, you know, this is maybe the wrong comparison, but it's just like getting dressed every morning. Like, you know, here we are stuck in the house. I don't want to necessarily have to find a great outfit every day, even though I did just buy some new sneakers that I'm really looking forward to wearing. That said, I don't have to think hard about it. And I have not found the consistency of mood that I could then link to a consistency of a music thing.
Right. Like, it just, music itself feels frivolous in this moment, it's let alone music writing. And, you know, that's a new one on me, and like not a terribly pleasant sensation for me.
Yeah. I mean, because even, you know, after 9/11, I had a day job then that was early enough in the internet, and I was working at an inessential enough place. Not that I didn't like the place, but it's not like, you know, it wasn't the New York Times. So like, if we didn't update for a week or two, it's at that point, it wasn't considered a cardinal sin. So I didn't have to force opinions about music. I could just wait for things to naturally kind of return to some kind of normalcy. But here we are, and I feel like with the piece I wrote about Imagine, I was like, oh, I have a very specific thought and feeling, and I just got to like purge it out of my system, and that feels right. And then I've written, you know, I wrote about the Uzi records, I wrote about this Balvin and Bunny thing, and I'm kind of like, these are fine.
Right.
Like, I'm trying to write good criticism. I'm trying to do my job well. But your hypothetical Eddie Vedder stan who's like waiting for your piece, I'm worried about that. I don't know if that person exists for me. And if that person exists, I don't know if I'm worried about them.
Right, right. I don't know what I want from music right now. I don't know what music can reliably deliver right now. And I'm trying to not listen to new music and think this music isn't rising to this moment, you know, because it's, again, it's not the music's fault. And I don't really even know what I'm looking for. If I'm looking for anger and release that way, if I'm looking to be soothed, it's just, it's, as you say, this is such a fluid situation, and it's just so bizarre and surreal that it's just, I don't really know what I want. And so I can't demand anything from music yet. And usually I'm in a stable enough place, or the world's in a stable enough place, where we have some idea of that.
Would you trash a record? The Imagine thing is like that's a special case.
It sure is.
a regular record, you know, so-and-so's third album, so-and-so's sixth album, like if you know, the week of April, whatever, something gets put out and it's just garbaggio, where are you at? You ready? You ready there with the hammer? You ready?
I feel like I've never been very good with the hammer again in the best of times. And so I can see a situation where, especially if this situation holds 2, 3, 4 weeks from now or months from now, and like I'm cooped up in cabin fever and whatever else, like there's a sense of catharsis that I will get, you know, from by trashing, like whatever, like the Strokes record. Like I can see that possibly. And I really want to love the Strokes record, but
you're stuck with it now. You have to trash it. You have to trash it. You're stuck. You're stuck. Sorry. I don't make the rules. I don't make the rules. You said it. Now you
I think
have to
you
do
actually
it.
Do. Okay. But it seems just as likely that I, at least, you know, in my meek Midwestern sort of way, would be like, this is not, you know, the world doesn't need more negativity right at this moment. And I don't want to do like the, you know, you haven't heard of this artist or this album, but like, it sucks. Like, I don't feel the need ordinarily to do that either. And so it's, I just can't tell how anyone, including myself, is going to feel 2 weeks from now. But I do think that I am less inclined in this environment to hate something, you know, or to feel the need to express to the world that I hate something. And that's not necessarily me trying to be altruistic or anything. It's just it feels extra frivolous in this moment, but maybe it shouldn't. I don't know. Maybe that's the wrong way to look at it.
I mean, I have not been so, like, the Balvin thing was like the first test, right? Typically you can avoid, you can dodge these things, right? Like I think as I get older, I'm less inclined to just like duck hunt like an unknown or small thing that nobody really knows about. Like, there's no point in that, I don't think. And so the duck hunts get saved for the kind of big ones, right? And I have not yet been presented with a super big record, Lady Gaga, where that could happen. I will be curious to see how I feel when that arrives. But I agree, it has not arrived yet. As we go out, tell me about the Pearl Jam record, because like, you know, I haven't listened to it.
I mean, it is very much a late period Pearl Jam record. Like, there's some super grouchy sort of rocker things at the beginning, and there's some super melancholy, like, back porch ballad type stuff at the ends. But again, it's like, it's in there are some very awkward like shots at Trump or whatever. Like, it's just, it's very much of a piece with them. It's been like 7 years or something, but they picked up right where they left off. And like, it's just the thing I always do with Pearl Jam is like, in the 90s, like the 70s was as far away as like we are from the 90s sitting. And I just, that the time, the chronology of Pearl Jam specifically freaks me out. Like, they were very important to me in junior high, which is like both kind of an insane thing to say and like absolutely the truth. And so it's very hard for me to talk about them critically in any kind of bloodless way again and like under normal circumstances. And so to be confronted with a record that's them just sort of half rousingly and half impotently like raging against the machine is like, oh, it's they're doing that thing. Like, I love that thing. I've always loved that thing. Like, when I was a kid, I especially loved that thing. It's like, do we need that thing right now? But it's cool that they're doing that thing. You know, I'm sort of just going around in circles in addition to, you know, sort of dodging the headlines as they roll in. And it's just a bizarre headspace to be in. But again, this is a band that I love historically and that I've written a ton about and then thought a ton about. And it's, you know, it's, I'd rather be putting in the work, however arduous, right now with a band that I already have that kind of relationship with and trying to assess like anything new.
That makes a lot of sense. And actually, this kind of, I don't want to say retreat to comfort, because I don't know if it's exactly comfort, but I think you're right that there is probably some critical value in, instead of confronting something completely unmoored, because we are in already unmoored times, there is probably some critical value in having a mooring walking in. That's fair. What's a good emblematic Pearl Jam song from the new record for us to go out with?
Oh, as I will be saying in the piece, if I ever get around to writing it, I've been playing air guitar to Super Blood Wolf Moon, which is a song title I'm very excited to say to you out loud, you know, in a public forum. I feel great about myself. But my answer to your question is Super Blood Wolf Moon.
Well, I never here are some words that I did not ever think I would say on podcast, but here's some Pearl Jam.
What a cluster clump.
True story. Rob, it's always a pleasure.
Likewise, man. Take care.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State.
Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. Christian nationalists are attacking these fundamental freedoms. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/NYT.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration. So I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Okay, so as I did in our first quarantine podcast, I'm here in the home office, surrounded by things. And so we're going to do J.C. Cribbs again. We're going to do it twice this episode in between each of the interviews. So I know that people are really into vinyl, and I respect people who are really into vinyl or any physical format. Not super into vinyl personally, but I do have a decent amount, and actually a lot of the vinyl that I have happens to be here in the office. It probably should be in storage, but it's here. So what I did is just a second ago, I went and kind of blindly grabbed one record just to see what it was and to talk about it. It's kind of an interesting record. So what I grabbed is the original DFA pressing of The Rapture's House of Jealous Lovers. You guys probably remember that from the early 2000s when dance punk was a thing, not the first time. You know, shouts to all the Gang of Fourheads out there. It's the one with the orange label. It's a white sleeve. It's got some schmutz on it, so I couldn't sell it as new on Discogs. This is a really interesting record because it was a lot of micro scenes sometimes end up getting defined by one band, one album, one song. And I remember devoting a lot of critical energy at that time to dance punk. I did a thing for Rolling Stone, I think, at the time. I like would go to the parties thrown by the Misshapes kids. And if the name Thomas Onorato means anything to you, you know what the Doors were like back then. The Rapture, even though they made other great songs, I don't know that they ever topped this song. I also don't know if the scene ever topped this moment. It feels like a real artifact. And it's strange because that was an artifact that was associated with a kind of physical set of parties, set of artists. I wonder if there was an equivalent scene in 2020 or 2025, how physical and locational that scene would be. And I don't just mean in the age of Corona. I mean, broadly speaking, a lot's changed in terms of the internet and social media and pop. This was a song that was really meaningful, but it was doubly meaningful on a dance floor, triply meaningful if you heard it live. So let's listen to a little House of Jealous Lovers by The Rapture. We are back. We are back with Lindsay Zolads. Lindsay, what's good?
I mean, not too much right now.
Exactly. That's the correct answer. That wasn't a trick question. That is the right answer. Lindsay is also one of the great music critics of our day. Lindsay writes for us. She writes for Pitchfork, Vulture, etc. Lindsay, I've been having anxiety about the role of criticism, more so than usual.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Most days. Where has your head been at as far as the practice of criticism and the value of criticism right now?
I'm sort of writing the first, I guess, official review type thing that I have written in the wake of all this, and definitely is feeling a little more difficult than usual. But I'm not sure. I'm finding it just difficult to write in this time in general.
Well, although you've written a couple things.
To prove that my brain was still working.
There's something different about writing about something that is on theme, right? That's like, here's a thing that's happening right now, and I have a response to it, and I'm a critic by nature, so it's going to be thoughtful and kind of careful and so on and so forth. There's a difference between that. Like, that to me was like writing about the imagined thing, you know? It's just like, that's happening right this second. They're like, let's weigh in. That's a little bit different than me writing about like the Uzi record, which is like not something that I have like a particular emotional moment for right now. It's hard to access the kind of like neutral, the ostensibly neutral frame of mind that you would ordinarily review a record in. And so I wonder, as you're kind of like scratching your way through this first review, where are you falling on the kind of arc of letting the outside world into your mode of writing, or keeping it at bay and trying to keep the review like a quote unquote pure space?
It's funny. I don't know yet which version of it I'm going to file, because I like the first thing I put down to paper was a quarantine related lead. And then as soon as I like stepped away from the draft, I was like, no, that can't be like everything right now. But at the same time, it does feel like everything. And I think the things that I read that don't engage with the present reality just feel like they're from a different planet right now. But at the same time, as you know, as a critic, part of what you're trying to do, at least in writing a good piece of criticism, is write something that's going to make sense a year from now, or put something into context. And the records that are coming out currently were not written and created in this moment, but they're being released into this moment. And I think it's going to be different. We're obviously going to get such a wave of all sorts of art, I guess, that people are making, you know, during this time. And I think there's going to be a lot of stuff that specifically speaks to this that comes out a little bit later. But I think you're right that there's something weird about this moment where we're listening to music that was made before this was all happening, and trying to make sense of it in a world where it's going to be received in a time really unlike any other we've gone through. And maybe it is the critic's job to kind of like pull those two realities together and figure out what makes sense.
I saw, and maybe you saw, I think it was both Ann Powers and Carl Wilson separately wrote about like the glut of coronavirus songs. Like, both you did that thing where you interviewed the guy, the producer who did the coronavirus, the Cardi, you know, the Cardi remix. But I guess, you know, there's obviously a glut of coronavirus songs. Certainly, if you look on like the viral charts, Spotify viral charts, there's a glut of coronavirus songs. And I think both Anne and Carl wrote pieces about them, and maybe some of the better ones. So that's like one way that like, OK, I have this skill, right? It's like some people know how to like make masks, and some people know how to like build buildings, and I know how to listen to records. So it's like, I guess I have this skill and I can apply it to the moment, to the art of the moment. But I haven't felt personally that specific kind of urgency. Mm. Have you felt anything like that? Like, I'm looking for the corona art and I want to like weigh in on the corona art. Have you felt that?
I haven't, beyond the extent of, you know, writing about the Cardi B coronavirus song, which I think, you know, to judge that on like aesthetic and artistic terms feels wrong right now and kind of beside the point. Like, I think that was just part of the reason why that was such a moment, is it did seem to exist outside of the whole world of like this being an actual single or something like that. It was just like a gonzo response to a wild moment.
Coronavirus. Sorry,
I only hear that word in her voice now, which is the only good thing that's happened in the last 2 weeks.
Like CNN should license that and just use it every time like Anderson Cooper talks about it. It should just dub in Cardi saying
it. Would make it so much better. Just everything.
Coronavirus! Woo!
It's interesting to me the kind of calculus of what the music industry is going through right now, and the calculus of like, do you release your record right now or not? If it was scheduled to come out in March and April and May. And, you know, I think that we're seeing a lot of those decisions are based on touring and how much the artist's revenue is comprised of the money they make off touring. And with a lot of bigger artists or more traditional minded mainstream artists, you're going to see that it makes sense to push back a Lady Gaga record or something like that if it's going to be in conjunction with a tour. But at the same time, we're all just sitting around right now, like looking for something to listen to and to do.
Agree.
And it's a little different than what you're seeing with the movie, the film industry, and just other industries that are kind of grinding to a halt. Now that we're pretty much exclusively in a streaming age and we don't need to physically go to the store to access these records, you know, I think some indie artists are wanting to hold their releases back to support independent record stores that are going to be really hurting, already are, and going to be in a pretty dire situation when this all dies down. But it's interesting because I think like for example, like the Weeknd record last week that came out, or even the Dua Lipa record that's coming out this week, like I do think there's just totally anecdotally more people sitting around wanting to just like check out what the new music is that drops on a Friday, because we're all kind of just like craving new content right now and catching up to this moment when it's not going to be produced as much. So I am interested, and I think there is an argument to be made that this is a great time at least to do some sort of digital release, because there's a ready waiting audience.
I've been banging this drum. I was just talking to Harvilla about this. This is like, I need a Rihanna record, like right now. Mm-hmm. I need you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like I need a Drake record right now. Like just take 12 songs that you have sitting on the hard drive, master them, put them out. Call them the quarantine tapes.
Do you want Drake's track about testing negative for coronavirus, but like thinking he had it because he hung out with Kevin Durant? That's like my favorite. It's my favorite little subplot here. And of course he got a test, you know, immediately, but
yes, obviously,
but Drake definitely just laid out some tracks in that like 36 hour period where he thought he probably had it. So I want that EP.
Drake put out on his Instagram story, he found that tweet where someone was like, Drake in the studio right now writing raps, like, can't tell if we're social distancing or you're distancing yeah. yourself from me, you know? And he just like,
he's been
like
waiting, I want for this that. Moment. Yeah.
Absolutely. Like Drake is so deep in his feelings right now. He's so thorough in his feelings that like whatever's coming out of that, I want that, and do it right now. Like just put it out on SoundCloud. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like there's no better time. And obviously the digital only release, and that's going to be a norm at a certain point. I think this might be partially a turning point for that. But I will also say the only piece of art that's sort of Corona art that I have felt really moved by and thought, hey, maybe this is worth writing about, is actually not a song at all. Have you seen those Miriam Banani videos, the two lizards videos?
No, tell me more.
Miriam Banani is like a Moroccan artist. She's put out two of these videos so far. They're like 2 or 3 minutes. They have like animatronic lizards, and they're basically in these kind of like Corona inspired setups. I don't know if the audio is stolen from something else and sort of put in the mouths of lizards, but the lizards are just kind of like on a rooftop or in a car, kind of like talking about coronavirus. It's like very durational in a way. And the two videos are very cool. And it's the only piece of Corona art that I thought is worth writing about. Maybe I should write about it. Maybe I should. All right. Maybe after we get off the phone, I'm going to send an email. Maybe I'll send an email. But that's the only thing so far. From a music perspective, there hasn't been anything yet. And on top of that, the only other thing, and this is, I wonder if this is something that maybe you're curious about or interested in accessing, I'm now starting to see other artistic input or production through the lens of Corona. And I don't mean like the Dua Lipa record. I mean like, here's some TV show I like, and I can never quite like identify why I like it or what's interesting about it specifically, but somehow through the lens of quarantine or isolation, it makes sense to me in a way that it didn't make sense to me previously. I'm having that experience of like reframing other art through this lens, like art that would kind of like waiting for a framework, and then coronavirus and quarantine all of a sudden arrived and gave that framing. I'm experiencing a little bit of that.
What specifically have you experienced that with?
I don't want to spoil it.
Okay. Save it for the piece.
I'm writing it for next week. I don't want to spoil it.
Okay, I feel you.
But I wonder if that's something that you've experienced at all, because it's one thing to sit around and wait for someone to give you something that's specific to the moment that you can then assess. It's a whole other thing to be like, this thing has been here all along and I see it differently now because of current circumstance.
I don't know if this is an exact answer to that, but I have been listening to a lot of ambient music, and I do generally anyway, like that is something I'm pretty keyed into, and just kind of for a practical purpose, because as a lot of people in New York, I think, are going through right now, one of the only businesses that has not stopped is the construction work going on. So there has been a persistent jackhammer like a block away from me as I am stuck in my apartment, and it's been driving me insane. So usually my sort of version of a white noise machine is just to blast like some chill vibes. And so I have been just listening to a lot of, do you know the band Bitchin' Bajas? They're like a droney experimental ambient thing. I've been putting a lot of their records on because it really like puts me in a good headspace and kind of clears the air. But another thing that I found, I was just talking with someone else about this too. I unfortunately did not get a chance to see the movie First Cow, the Kelly Reichardt movie. It was like the next thing on my list of when I go to the movies again, and then now we don't know when that's going to be, but I have been listening to the score for that movie that William Tyler, who's a great guitarist, did it. And I was just listening to it earlier today because it's like, it reminds me of being outside. That's what I realized. What was appealing to me. There's like bird noises in the mix and like babbling water and stuff. And I think I just realized like, oh, this is giving me outside vibes that I wish I was having now. And a lot of, you know, and it's also just like, I think there's this pull of wanting to go back to the movies again and feeling kind of thwarted in that way. But I just love movie scores and things like that. And this one is really just scratching the itch right now. So
you want to go out on something from the First Cow soundtrack?
As you were intending when you asked me.
When I woke up this morning, I said, how can I route Popcast to arrive at the First Cow soundtrack? And I did it.
I'm happy to assist. Let's go with one that has a really pastoral title. Let's do A Clearing in the Field. Because it would be really nice to be in a field right now. That's all.
Someday, maybe in July, we'll get to do that.
I would love it. But until then.
Until then, Lindsay Zolads, a champ. I appreciate you. Stay healthy.
Thank you, John. You too.
So I'm looking around my office again. I went over to the bookshelf. I have one shelf that is devoted exclusively to biographies and autobiographies of rappers. So the one that I pulled was a kind of almost like a chapbook. It's a self-publication, I'm pretty sure. It's called The Science of Rap. It's by KRS-One. I want to say this came out in the late 90s. Maybe the early 2000s? Oh, no, I'm wrong. 1996 is the copyright on this. KRS-One, if you don't know, is from Boogie Down Productions, a very important group from the Bronx in the mid to late 80s. And KRS-One was certainly in the late 80s, probably into the late 90s, if we're being honest, like sort of an ongoing moral authority in hip hop. He was someone who, in so much as there was a gatekeeper of things that were perceived as authentic or inauthentic, KRS-One was that figure. He very famously or infamously pushed Prince B of PM Dawn off the stage at maybe a New Music seminar event in 1992 or 1993. This was like a big kerfuffle at the time. KRS has written a couple of books. This was, I believe, the first of the books. Not 100% sure. Don't quote me on that. And KRS has particularly been on my mind because of the D-Nice Instagram live party, which I believe we're going to talk about with Craig when he calls in. D-Nice came up under Boogie Down Productions, and he played a little bit of old KRS-One. So let's hark back to a different time in hip hop, a time when a book called The Science of Rap would be taken seriously, which is, it's very different now. I think today's generation of MCs maybe would not want to read what's in this book, which is a lot of things. You've got everything from sound requirements for live shows to the definition of a freestyle. It's very kind of a, 100 essential laws of being a rapper. The book is The Science of Rap. The author is KRS-One. Let's listen to MCs Act Like They Don't Know.
If you don't know me by now, I doubt you'll ever know me. I never won a Grammy, I won't win a Tony, but I'm not the only MC keeping it real. When I grab the mic and smash rap, my girls go ill. Check the time as I rhyme, it's 1995 whenever I arrive. The party gets liver, flow with the master rhymer. That's a leap behind a video rapper. You know the chalk rhymer.
Finally, our third guest, Taking Out You Suckers and You Don't Know How He Did It. Craig Jenkins checking in, also one of the great pop critics of the day. Craig, tell me what's going on where you're at. I know you were texting. You said there's some noise out the window. What's good where you're at?
I'm in Harlem. It is sort of like a regular day, but
yeah,
there's a tenth of the people that would normally be outside.
Right.
It's a little unusual. It's just super low traffic for like the time of year. Like normally the streets are booming and stuff. I'm hearing music. I'm hearing the occasional truck and maybe three people walking the street at one time, if you're lucky, usually zero.
Motorcycles on deck or not?
Motorcycles still zooming through the neighborhood, though.
Yeah, zooming away from coronavirus. What can you say?
I envy anyone who has a vehicle right now. Like, it seems like that's the cool way to get about places until they start shutting down streets or whatever.
That's what I was going to say. I read something on Twitter that in Los Angeles, the cops are stopping you. And if they think that the place that you're going is not essential, they're giving out tickets.
See, they should have been doing that like everywhere. Tickets are the answer.
I don't disagree. But as a person with a car, I'm also like, don't pull me over. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to interact with the police. If I can avoid interacting with police.
That's definitely the problem with closing things down, is the answer to keeping the traffic low is like the cops. And that's not tight for anybody.
Exactly. I remember last weekend, which is to say 6 days ago or whatever.
Infinity hours ago. What is time anymore?
Right. Exactly. Walking around and there were cops. There were cops on almost every block. There was either a car or a patrol officer, and it was extremely jarring. That's not the city I want to live in.
You only see that when there's like a parade or like a concert, a rap show somewhere.
Right. It was distressing. So another thing that happened last weekend was the D-Nice Instagram Live jump off. You wrote about it as part of a larger thing about kind of how musicians are proto-fitting, retrofitting. I'm not sure what the verb is, but kind of like shrinking themselves into phone size in order to entertain people in this particular moment. You touched on a lot of stuff that I was not aware of. The D-Nice thing was an interesting moment because I'm actually curious what your feeling about this was. When I was watching it, I was like, I don't know if I want to write about this. Like, maybe I should just let this be. You know what I mean? Imposing the act of criticism onto it felt maybe incorrect to me at that moment. What was your feeling about it? And obviously you chose to write about it. So tell me about that process.
Once like the NFL and like the Netflix Instagram account started showing up in the comments, it felt like it was an inevitable thing that people were going to be talking about. So I didn't want to really like show up and just be like, oh, like here's this thing, but rather to sort of document the experience of like totally laying in bed all Saturday night, but still feeling like it wasn't like a boring night at all. Like, it's unusual. I'm usually somewhere on Friday and I don't really do well with like spending many weekends inside, but like this one, the D-Nice show really felt like going somewhere a little bit. Like, and then, you know, I checked into the DJ Premier thing afterward and it was like, wait, like this is what happens when you walk around festival grounds and you catch bits of amazing sets and then you like cash out at the end of the night.
I screen grabbed on the D-Nice thing. Like, I screen grabbed a bunch of celebrity comments because I was just like, well, you know, I just kind of want them for the archive. But the moment that I got most excited about, obviously Kenny Rogers had just passed away. And he starts playing The Gambler, and Angie Martinez wrote in. She's like, never count your money when you're sitting at the table is a bar. And I was just like, what a great, like, this is all, like, literally all the threads are converging. Like, Instagram, the death of Kenny Rogers, coronavirus, people trapped at home, celebrity culture, like everything is collapsed into this one moment. So that was like kind of heartening. And I agree. It was like I didn't feel like I was trapped inside when I was paying attention to that. You know, I felt like this is a thing that I was happy to be able to choose to do. Have you felt that way, broadly speaking, about other music that you've had to engage with professionally over the last 10 days or 2 weeks?
I've either felt like it's a good distraction, or I felt like, you know, a record comes out and I'm like, you mean to tell me I can't be outside with this? Like, The Weeknd dropped and I'm still mad about the fact that I cannot terrorize people with such tunes in the bar. So
wait, is that your game? I didn't even know. I've never been
tunes terrorism. Absolutely.
Wait, 100%. I've never been to the bar with you. I didn't know that was your game.
I will definitely occupy like a 40-minute set in the bar and then just be around like
oh my lord. Okay, all right, well, so if friends of Craig, you have that to look forward to on the other side of Armageddon. Okay, what else besides that?
The Dua Lipa record that comes out this week. It's definitely one where you want to be out with people, but you can't do it. So there's those, and then there's like moments like the sort of late night Erykah Badu set where it was just like, I'm glad that this is happening. Or, you know, Questlove the other night. Well, nightly.
Yes.
You know, spinning kind of random stuff, going into the archives.
You've written a little bit about music. I mean, you've written a few pieces, rather, in the last couple weeks. But you didn't like review the Weeknd record. You didn't like, there aren't like straight reviews. Is that partially
because that's actually coming up. I'm trying to get creative with it. I kind of want to balance out like just the straight up reviews with some experiential stuff.
Yes.
Like I feel like sort of the calling when you're a culture writer and there's a weird moment is to try and like document either for the present or for the future sort of what it feels like, you know, try and make some sense of it, or even just like document you're trying to make sense of it. But yeah, that's what I feel like I'm doing right now. There are going to be some straight reviews on the immediate horizon. And that's just because like getting like monomania about a record is like sort of how I pass the time.
Yes, yes, yes. Because I sort of have had this struggle of like, what is the value of a straight review? Like I just reviewed like the Balvin and Bad Bunny records. And I was like, well, I'm glad I did this. I'm glad that this review exists. But man, this review feels meaningless on March 26, 2020. You know what I mean? Like this review, literally, I don't know what the utility of this is. I don't know. Also don't know who's waiting for this. Like who's out there like, yes, in the middle of quarantine, finally, the double Balvin Bunny review. Like finally. I don't know.
It's something to do. It's something for us to do. And it's something for, you know, people who are kind of bored and in the house to do. That's just how I feel about it. You know, like we're all trying to fill up the day now, the nights now, more than we were normally when we were able to go outside. And so like, man, I'm watching stuff that I never thought I'd be watching before. I'm deep into Tiger King right now.
Yeah, yo, me too.
I think I hate it. I don't know. Like, I can't really tell if I like it or not.
wait. Quick sidebar. What do you hate about Tiger King?
Like, there's just a level of pettiness that is, like, so, like, inside baseball. Like, you know how they're mad at Carol Baskins and she has better SEO? Like,
yeah.
Like, I don't want to hear that stuff. Like, that stuff you overhear, like, you know, outside on someone on an angry phone call and you're like, man, that person, like, I'm really glad I don't have to stick with that. Oh, but yeah, there's like 7 hours worth of this thing.
I guess I just sort of assumed that was the raison d'etre of that particular thing. You know what I mean? Like I sort of like, if you're going to do this at length, you're going to do it at depth as well. You know, it's not a two hour thing. It's not a standalone 2 hour doc.
I feel like they could have wrapped it in four, but you know, it has that like sort of Kanye West, Taylor Swift quality to it where it's just like, I can't remember where this started or like why this is continuing to go, but I'm going to follow it because what else do I have to do kind of thing? Like,
mm-hmm. Speaking of Kanye and Taylor, that's interesting because so they have had a bit of a busy week and I can't think of a thing that I less want to think about than Kanye and Taylor's ongoing struggles. What an absurd time for that to be reignited. The internet doesn't need that right now. And if anything, it's the rare thing that's come out in the last week where I'm like, this is not important. Like, stop this. Like most culture, even if it's dumb, I'm like, you know what? It's fine. I'll give it a pass. But with that, I was like, literally stop it. Like, be adults. Don't be on the internet.
Well, you know, it was kind of like, oh, like I'm above this Olympics. Although like I'm giving the point to Taylor this time. I think that
sure.
Now that we have seen more footage, that we were all, at least I was wrong about her, the way that she handled that. It seemed like she was being manipulative, but it was the other way around. But yeah, exactly. Like,
to be fair, both sides are being manipulative. Like, let's not. We're well, not excusing like, I mean, anybody. Like,
I mean, like, just if you look back at what she said at, you know, the Grammy thing where she really flamed him, like, yeah. It kind of stands.
Yeah.
He was telling half-truths, and she was guessing it. I would love to hear what he thinks about the moment, though. Not about the beef, but about what's happening right now with his friend and superhero president. But that's for another time.
Yeah, no, and I agree. And also, like, you out here having Sunday service, and that's 100 people in very close proximity. You know what I mean?
Like, he was supposed to do Yankee Stadium, and that would have had my whole neighborhood clogged up with hypebeasts, so I'm kind of, like, relieved. Maybe that's not happening.
Do you think that if you were presented, say next week, you know, a record comes out and you think it was just wild trash, but it was an important record, do you think like you feel comfortable flaming that record in this particular cultural moment?
It depends. Like, how can it be trash and also important?
Oh, there's plenty of important records are trash. Oh, come on, man. You know that. You know,
like,
that
those okay, two like, are not. This of note, but like,
sure.
This is a good question. Yeah, I'm definitely like, I'm glad that the stuff that's coming out that I'm hearing is really good, but that I'm not like chilling on a record because like the world is in disarray. It's always been that way.
Right. Like you could still get the smoke.
Yeah, absolutely.
It doesn't matter.
I tell you what, I have like a severely like lessened capacity for smoke, but like,
okay,
you know, in a classy way, I would definitely flame a record if I needed to.
Yeah, I mean, look, I like to think I've been classily flaming records for decades now. Sort of. That's what I hope. I hope what I'm remembered for is classy flaming of records. That's what I would hope is on my epitaph. I do have this moment where I'm like, if a super important record came out by a major artist and it was not it, like, do you basically want to be a person to start a conflagration when there is already a forest fire going on outside, you know? And that's something that we as critics think about all the time. I think it's like we're always mindful of it. But in this particular moment of collective tenderness and sensitivity, I don't know, feels a little bit more pointed than usual to me.
I mean, I tell you what, though, because in this moment, like, I've been lurking social media a lot this week, as we all have, and there are people getting absolutely destroyed on there. So, like, I think that a lot of the energy that people have, you know, that used to go into nightlife and used to go into seeing people, is going into, like, cutting up. So, like, who's really going to be upset if I do that?
Right. So, basically, what I think what if I'm hearing Craig correctly, what he's basically saying is it's open season on all you suckers. It's been. Is there anything that you've heard in the last week or two or that you know you're working on the next few days that really has jumped out at you and speaking loudly to you?
Well, I do like the Dua Lipa album and how there's like mad references to not going outside. You know what I am thinking about is like what's going to happen when like all the stuff that's happening in studios right now starts trickling out. Like, what are these songs going to be about? What is the Corona music going to... Because we were already in like 4 years of super like, if not sort of tacit and like open political music, even from people you wouldn't expect. So it's like, what is this going to make? Like, what are the plague bops?
I totally agree. And also I've been wondering, like, I haven't read any articles, like the studio culture in Los Angeles is like ordinarily so kind of non-socially distanced, you know, it's like songwriters bouncing from room to room, producers bouncing from room to room, top liners. So I'm sort of wondering how that ecosystem is adjusting to the current reality, number one. And second to that, what you just brought up, which is like, what are they singing about? What are they writing about? We have no idea. So I'll be curious to see. You want to go out on a Dua Lipa song about not going outside?
All right.
What's the one? Tell me.
Let's do Don't Start Now. There's some social distancing to those lyrics.
All right. Well, I hope to never be socially distanced from you, Craig Jenkins. Thank you for coming on this week. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That's our show. Thanks to Lindsay. Thanks to Rob. Thanks to Craig. Listen to every podcast ever. nytimes.com/podcast. Email us podcast@nytimes.com. Let us know if you think we should be out here flaming records in the age of coronavirus. Don't forget about the Facebook group. It's jumping off. They're having all kinds of conversations. I can't keep up. Get involved. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content. iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, iHeart, etc., etc. Our producer in the crib, Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Did a full 180, crazy.
about the way I want his to